your host, Tegan Keating. This week, I am going to try something kind of different. One of my childhood best friends is in town. Her name's Jessamine Doan. She is defending her dissertation on Wednesday, and she's staying with me while she gets ready for that. So I thought it would be fun to have her on the podcast this week, but she doesn't know anything about public health. So I start off this interview by talking to her about, you know, what she's doing, and she lives in Louisiana now, and we talk a little bit about that kind of stuff. And then I found that the New York Times does these health quizzes based on some of the health articles that they publish each week. And so I quizzed her on health news, and it was actually a lot of fun and pretty interesting. The quiz this week was pretty heavy on the diet and exercise questions. So, you know, she does pretty well, but I'm not gonna spoil it for you or anything. So, also, you can possibly hear this in my voice. I am a little bit under the weather, so I apologize if you can hear me sniffling or if my voice sounds scratchy and horrible. Fighting off a spring cold. So, here she is. This is the wonderful, lovely Jessamine Doan. This week, I have one of my oldest, she's not old, but I've known her for a long time, dearest friends, Jessamine Doan.
Hi.
She is my guest this week. She, is the reason that I moved to Philadelphia, and she enticed me here, and now she's left me, a few years ago, and is back to defend her dissertation on Wednesday. When you're listening to this, she'll be defending her dissertation, or she'll be Dr. Jessamine Doan.
Yee!
She's fist pumping. You can't see that, but she is. Oh, a Cleo toy. Sorry, guys. So, hi, Jessamine.
Hi, Tegan.
How are you?
Very excited to be here with you.
Good. I'm glad that you're here with me, too.
Always exciting.
So, tell me, you're not in public health, so you're my first non-public health guest. So, welcome to the public health podcast.
I hear about public health from you, and music is related to not health at all.
Well, okay, talk to me a little bit about what you're getting your PhD in, what you will have your PhD in just a mere 2 days.
I study ethnomusicology, which is the anthropology of music. So I look at music as a cultural system rather than music as a series of notes on a page or a series of, well, it's that too, I guess, but my focus is looking at music as a cultural system, and so I work in Louisiana with Cajun music, which is a traditional music that has been revived in sort of the past 30 or 40 years to a currently thriving and vibrant scene. And so what I've been writing about is how that scene is constructed and what happens after you sort of save a music from dying. What's the next step? You've got a few more people playing it, and now 30 years later, where is it? And so I've looked at the way that tourism has played a major role in sort of preserving and continuing that musical tradition.
And Louisiana one of its major industries is tourism, right?
Absolutely. Especially in Southwest Louisiana. I work in Lafayette, Louisiana. In that region, it's tourism and oil. Oil's bigger and makes more money for people, but tourism and oil are the two things that people do out there. In New Orleans, I'm sure tourism is probably the number one industry in New Orleans because oil isn't as big a thing over there. So, I mean, it dominates the whole state. And for sure, any cultural music, food, there's a growing film industry in Louisiana that's maybe not quite as related to tourism, but everything else is funded almost entirely by tourist dollars and tourist promotions.
That's really interesting because I would imagine that there's a lot of environmental issues that go along not only with oil, but if tourism is such a huge part of your economy, there's got to be some issues with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have two, I mean, with oil, you've got a whole separate set of environmental issues. Yeah. There's a whole, I mean, it's already a very unique ecosystem because you've got the Mississippi Delta and you've got the shifting coastlines that we haven't quite figured out what to do with, because ideally Louisiana's coastlines would just always change. But we're not really willing to give up land. Once we build something, we like it to stay there. Right. So there are certain places where we fortified the coastline so it can't change naturally anymore. And instead what that means is it's still eroding from some places. It's just not building up in new places. So there's all sorts of environmental issues with coastlines and wetlands all through the region.
So people are basically losing their home.
Yeah. There's a town that's losing a square mile a year. Wow. And so far, it's slow enough that it doesn't seem to have been... Or I haven't heard about homes necessarily, but, you know, it's the land, it's your coastal land, it's the town's land, it's beachfront. Well, there isn't really beach because it keeps eroding, but it's what would be your waterfront. And I'm sure people, you have enough warning usually that your home wouldn't just disappear one day necessarily, but you might need to move so that that was different. But then with the tourism, you have things like swamp tours, which bring people down specifically to see Louisiana's ecosystems. So in Cajun country, there's a whole tradition of...
Where is that in Louisiana?
Southwest Louisiana.
Okay.
So Lafayette is sort of the central city of that region, and it's an hour east of the Texas border and 2 hours west of New Orleans. So it's not the furthest corner of the state, but it's much closer to that side than where we typically think of when we visit Louisiana. And so these swamp tours have people who put on strong Cajun accents and sort of play up the role of hick, you know, bayou men who take people out on tours, because otherwise you don't get to see the wetlands and the swamps. They're not easy enough to travel by that you could necessarily do it on your own. And so that, in addition to the music and the food, is kind of the third major piece of what people do when they're not in New Orleans, when they explore the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that is totally rooted in sort of environment and ecosystem and people's livelihoods, not just giving these tours, but hunting and fishing. If that's not how people make money anymore, it is how people like to spend their weekends. And so a lot of that is very tied up in land and preservation. And so there's a strong drive to kind of protect the environment and not litter and do lots of cleanups that's rooted less in a general sense of environmental sustainability and more in a very specific, I have things I want to do with this land.
Which is so interesting because politically, stereotypically, that is not what you would think people would be into, particularly because Louisiana is an oil state.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things for me living there has been how, as a relatively liberal person living in a relatively conservative state, where obviously there are individuals who kind of blur all of that, but how many similar conclusions that I would come to from a leftist perspective about the importance of supporting local businesses, which for me is an alternative to global and multinational corporations that treat workers poorly, for instance. In Louisiana, in Lafayette, where I live, there's a huge movement to support local businesses, but not because they're an alternative to corporations necessarily, but from an almost libertarian perspective of, like, you want to avoid government, you want to avoid interacting with any of these big things. If it's your neighbor's business, support your neighbor's business. So it's rooted in these, what we think of as almost more small town values, or things that do get back into a conservative worldview. And it's the same with the environment kinds of stuff that people, it's so that there can be more hunting and fishing. State parks always have space for fishing, and not usually hunting, I guess, but there's always fish, lakes are made for fishing in. And so you wouldn't preserve land from that necessarily, but you absolutely would preserve land and waterways and fight pollution and fight littering in order to allow for more.
It seems almost like a less idealistic way of thinking about environmentalism. Absolutely. Because there's a real reason why you want to maintain things the way they are.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So the idealism, I mean, and again, individuals, there are lots of people who think it's beautiful and want to preserve it for that reason. But for most of the people that I talk to, there's a very clear need to preserve the environment. And that need is for hunting and fishing, which are still like the livelihoods of plenty of people. There's lots of fishermen in Louisiana. Hunting probably less makes people money, but you've got your Swamp People TV shows about the alligator hunters and the...
Oh, isn't Duck Dynasty in Louisiana?
It's in Louisiana, yeah.
It is in Louisiana.
It's not down in Lafayette. It's 2 hours north of us. But yeah, you've got...
Where is that?
It's in Monroe, Louisiana, which is sort of the north center of the state.
Okay.
I think it's probably at 2.5 or 3 hours north of where I live.
Okay.
But yeah, that's a duck call. So that's hunting is one of the, again, people aren't probably making their own livings as hunters, but it's a huge hobby, and so there's a huge industry that comes up around that. I think the show Swamp People is about gator hunters.
I've never heard of that show.
Oh, that was like the big one. That was the prior to Duck Dynasty. Swamp People got really big, and it was the beginning of the sort of, there's a whole Cajun craze or Louisiana craze in TV right now.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, I know that, I think you were telling me about the governor?
He was maybe the first Cajun governor, certainly the most important Cajun governor was Edwin Edwards. since he was like governor at least 20 years ago. Since he then went to jail because he was corrupt in office, right. He's now like 90 and married to like a 20-something-year-old. So there was a TV show about his marriage, a reality show about his marriage to a young wife. But also, it's gone now because he's running for governor again after getting out of jail for corruption as governor of Louisiana. So that was one. There's Swamp People and Duck Dynasty and Cajun Pawn Stars and Cajun something else.
There's Cajun Pawn Stars?
There's Cajun Pawn Stars.
Wow.
HBO has had Tremé, which is the show about New Orleans and music,
right.
But also this year was True Detective with Matthew McConaughey. True Blood, yeah. Which is sort of generically set in Cajun country, kind of, but no particular place. But True Detective, the show that I think it was the spring, with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson,
mm-hmm.
was set in and around Lafayette. Like one of the
really?
Characters worked at the hospital that's down the street from not for real, but the hospital was filmed there, and the name was the same name. So there is this sort of wave of Cajun or Louisiana-themed things that's coming mm-hmm. up again.
So it's really different from other places you've lived, because we grew up in the same hometown. We grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. And
I'm pride.
Yeah. And then we both lived in Philadelphia. So, and Lafayette is totally different.
Totally different. To a certain extent, it's probably more similar to Tallahassee than Philadelphia, and there are things in common. You know, it's a sort of medium-sized southern town, small city, 200,000 people-ish.
I think that's a city.
Yeah, it's a small city,
yeah.
But it's a real city. And it's got things in common with other southern towns, for sure.
Yeah, I mean,
but the unique focus on like this particular kind of tourism and this particular kind of heritage, which really dominates everything. The mm-hmm. farmers market has a Cajun jam.
What's a Cajun jam?
Musicians playing informally in a circle. They like hire people to come and lead it, though, to make sure there's always Cajun music led by good musicians.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a kind of jelly.
That's what I was going to ask.
Strawberry jam, yeah. That's, no, it's not that.
At a farmer's market.
It's true. Strawberry jam, Cajun jam, and blueberry preserves.
Well, like, you know, Cajun seasoning.
Maybe that's why they have a Cajun jam at the farmer's market. Maybe it's a giant pun. Maybe it's a physical instantiation of a pun.
Maybe it is. You heard it here first, folks. Cajun jam is a tip of jelly. So, all right. So, we're going to take a break for a second. Okay, Jessamine. So, since you're not a public health professional, unlike all of the other guests I've had on the podcast.
That is a true statement.
And you are simply a wonderful human being who I thought would be fun to have on the show. I have found for us, well, for me, to quiz you on the past week's New York Times weekly health quiz. How's that sound?
It sounds wonderful, Tegan.
Okay, good.
I will do my best.
So it's every week the New York Times runs a health quiz based on the stories that they have run over the past week. It's 7 questions, and I'm going to ask you the question, and you have to tell me if you know what you think the answer is.
So
and then
see how up on my health news I actually am.
How up on the New York Times version of the health news you are. I don't know.
In preparation for visiting you, clearly I did my research.
I will find out.
We will find out.
So I am going to give you a grade at the end.
Oh, good.
Because you are about to graduate from grad school and you're never going to get another grade again. So let me
so
be the last.
Might as well make the most of it now.
Let me be the last one to give you a grade. There's only 8 questions, so it's pretty high stakes. Don't mess up. Okay.
I'm going to get my first failing grade from you.
Hey,
seems
look.
Seems distinctly possible.
Somebody has to do it.
That's right. I'd rather come from a friend.
All right. So the first question is, true or false? Cooling down after exercise helps prevent cramps. Yeah. Muscle cramps.
Let's say true.
True?
Yeah. Cooling down is good. I know that it helps prevent like stiffness and soreness, but probably also cramps. Yes. True.
Final answer.
Final answer.
Wrong. It's false. Oh, no.
Already I'm on my way to a failing grade.
You are. All right, so let's see what New York Times has to say about that. Apparently, a study recently... Oh, no. It didn't recently come out. Thanks, New York Times, for being timely. In 2007, a study came out saying that cool downs don't actually help with cramps. They are still helpful.
See, I knew they were helpful for something.
Like, you shouldn't just stop working out because you don't want your blood to pool in your blood vessels.
Does it help with stiffness and soreness?
It doesn't seem to. I mean, this study that they're writing about doesn't talk about stiffness and soreness. It mostly talks about blood pooling in your blood vessels, resulting in dizziness or fainting.
Oh, but that's a good thing to avoid, though. All right. So I might still get cramps, but I won't faint.
Well, no, it's just that that cooling down won't prevent cramps.
Okay. So whether I get them or not is unrelated to whether I cool down.
Yes. And as this article says, if you enjoy cooling down, continue. You have little to lose except time.
Time is valuable, though. Near New York Times. Minutes. Am I supposed to cool down or not?
Well, they're not going to tell you. That's between you and your doctor.
Okay. I'll ask my medical professional.
So this is actually part of a New York Times, it's part of their health blog called Well, and it was, it looks like they have readers ask questions, and then other readers vote on the questions that they're going to answer.
So if you have an opinion that you have a question you want answered, get all your friends involved.
Exactly.
Vote it up.
Put it on Facebook,
vote it up.
All right.
Dear New York Times, should I cool down? That's my question for them.
All right. So, question number two.
All right.
This is diet.
Better luck this time.
Diet related.
Okay.
Eating about 3/4 cup a day of these foods led to drops in LDL cholesterol.
Can you remind me if LDL is good or bad cholesterol?
Yeah, I sure can. It's the bad cholesterol.
So HDL is good cholesterol.
Yes.
So drops in LDL is
a good thing. So let's be clear.
Okay.
It's bad in quotes and good in quotes.
But one you want more, one more of is okay and one less of is better. It's good to have low LDL levels.
Yes. Okay. Based on my non-knowledge of cholesterol levels. It's not my area of expertise. Okay.
You can edit that part out then.
Okay, so, nah. It's fine. I'm okay with saying I don't know things. All right, so there was a review of studies that came out. Are you cheating?
I'm not trying to.
Okay. Or fresh herbs.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Peas or beans, leafy greens, root vegetables, fresh herbs. So 3/4 cup a day of leafy greens is really not very much. So I'm going to say not that.
That's like half a handful.
Yeah. So I think not that, because 3/4 cup can't be enough to make a difference. Several cups maybe, but not that. So now I'm left with peas and beans, root vegetables, or herbs.
Fresh herbs.
3/4 cup a day is a lot of herbs. So either the surprise is we should all be seasoning our food a lot more, or that's not it either.
Instead of salad, you should just be eating parsley.
Parsley. Basil. Chopped basil, chopped parsley, and chopped cilantro. Those of you who don't like cilantro, you're done. You're out. Never going to get to 3/4 cup. So I'm going to say not fresh herbs. That seems like too much.
Okay.
So now we're looking at root vegetables or peas and beans. I think peas and beans. Legumes are good for all sorts of things.
Ding, 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 ding,
yes!
Ding.
Yes!
You are one correct. For two. You are correct. The peas and beans are the way to go. So let's see what New York Times has to say about this. Peas and beans. You like beans.
Love
peas.
Beans. Yeah. Peas. Peas are one of my favorite vegetables, especially when they're like fresh and sweet in the spring.
Yeah, like now.
Like right now.
Yes. So, okay, it's not a huge reduction. It's about a 5% reduction in LDL cholesterol, which translates to about a 5 or 6% reduction in heart attacks and other major cardiovascular events.
So it's not nothing.
No, it's certainly not nothing. It's not as if you eat 4.5 ounces of beans a day, you're suddenly don't have anything to worry about. But there's something going for it.
Plus they're delicious.
They are. But what's really interesting is that the average American eats less than 1 ounce of beans and peas a day.
And we're saying 4 ounces is what we
4.5.
4.5 ounces a day.
Okay. According to this.
3/4 of a cup?
Yeah, it's 4.5 ounces of weight, okay. Not volume.
Okay.
So it's just, it's another thing that Americans can add into their diet that will only help.
Like chili? You could put a lot of, probably get that many beans in your chili.
Yeah, or just eat hummus.
I eat a lot of hummus.
Well, just add a little bit of hummus at first. You know, just a little bit.
Oh, no, I do eat a lot of hummus. I'm getting my 3/4 of 4.5 ounces of.
That's a lot of hummus. That's like a whole Sabra container of hummus.
It happens sometimes.
I guess if that is your lunch, just hummus on a spoon.
Just on my finger.
So I mean, the researchers, it was a meta study. So they looked at 26 different studies about beans. Man, that...
What a life.
It really is. I'm a little bit jealous. I'd like to be a bean researcher.
Career path. New career goals.
If anyone's hiring for bean researchers, I'm available. I'm available June 14th.
She'll have a master's in public health. Totally set to be a bean researcher.
So what they're saying is just that this is... It's a good opportunity for people to add more healthy food into their diet. So, any more bean thoughts?
Eat them. They're delicious. LDL's not good for you, so lower it.
That's Dr. Doan speaking.
That's correct. It's almost like I'm a medical doctor.
No, it's not.
Like I'm a medical doctor.
Don't take anything she said. It's medical advice.
Except that the New York Times told you also.
Okay, question number 3. Regular exercise had this effect on skin.
Mm.
So you have to tell me what effect regular exercise had on skin.
Okay.
I thought that was a strangely worded question.
Okay.
It keeps skin looking younger. It ages skin prematurely. Ooh. It decreases the risk of skin cancer. Or it increases the risk of skin cancer.
Okay. So, I think it has not much to do with skin cancer, because in my mother's family, there's lots of exercise and also lots of skin cancer, but I don't think anybody's ever said those two things are related, because if you run outside in the sunshine, you could get more skin cancer, and if you only exercise inside in the gym, I think it's irrelevant. So I'm going to say not either of those.
Okay.
So now we have keeps your skin looking younger, which is what we would all like to think happens if we exercise, and it prematurely ages you, which would be very sad news for people who already don't want to exercise. So let's go optimistic. Let's say that it keeps your skin looking younger, though I'm quite afraid the answer is going to be that it ages you prematurely.
Well, I'm happy to report that you are correct.
Yay!
Regular exercise, according to this article in the New York Times, does keep your skin looking younger.
One more reason to do it, guys.
Exactly. So,
Dr. Doan again. Look hot, eat beans.
Look hot and eat beans.
Oh, sound medical advice.
No, again, don't listen to her. So, I mean, basically they looked at the skin of two comparable groups of people, some who exercised, some who didn't. The people who exercised had better looking, like their skin looked like the skin of younger people.
No, that's a very solid benefit. That's a good reason to keep exercising. In addition to all the other things it gives you.
Yeah. And not just for vanity purposes, but just like simply for longevity.
Yeah. The longer you can keep your skin looking young, the longer you've got skin that's healthy.
Exactly. So it's pretty interesting.
How much exercise? What does exercise regularly mean in this context?
Let's see. What do they say? 3 hours of moderate or vigorous physical activity every week. While the other group was resolutely sedentary, exercising for less than an hour per week. Oh, this is important. they didn't look at facial skin or like arms and hands. They looked at skin on the buttocks.
Ooh, even better.
Because I guess they wanted to not have sun be a factor.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Because that's what the skin cancer was, I was saying. Yeah. That has to do with sun and not sun. So this is not even face.
No. This is covered. If you want
your butt to look younger.
If you want the skin on your butt to look younger.
But I'm pretty sure if you exercise and get it all, it's good all around. Good all around.
So yeah, that's...
All right. So 3 hours a week. 3 hours a week of moderate exercise.
So that's 6 days a week, 30 minutes a day.
Doable, guys.
Very easy. Go for a walk. It's fun. It's easy.
Make you look younger.
It'll make your butt skin look younger.
Smooth as a baby's bottom. You've heard that phrase. Now the New York Times tells you how to do it.
Okay, let me mark you down as a win two for that one.
Doing better than I thought. 66%. Okay, look, it was initially looking bad.
That's true. All right. Improved. Number four. Rates of this diabetes complication has fallen markedly in recent decades.
Oh.
Kidney failure, heart attacks, amputations, or all of the above? Did you know
rates of this diabetes complication?
Yes. Did you know that all of those are related to diabetes?
So I actually did know that amputations were related.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised that heart attacks are related.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the third one?
Kidney failure.
I'm not surprised about that one either, although I wouldn't have named it. So I am sure that amputations as a result of, in the past how many years?
Recent decades.
Okay, so I'm sure amputations have gone down as a result of diabetes, because I'm sure that amputations have gone down in general recently.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. So then the question is my answer amputations or is my answer all of the above? I think it's all of the above. I bet we've gotten much better, because I'm sure we're better at monitoring insulin, and I'm sure we're better at knowing how to talk to people about what to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in recent decades, we've gotten better at all of that. So let's say that we're doing well with our health care providing. And we are helping diabetics not suffer any of those really bad consequences.
Hooray! All of the above. You're correct.
Yes!
You're doing great.
I know my health.
So yes, diabetes... is basically being better controlled now.
I mean, I feel like the machines to test your insulin level daily have gotten easier to use and less painful and more accurate, probably.
Which is very interesting. The biggest declines were in the rates of heart attacks and deaths from high blood sugar.
Which is what those machines measure.
Not a heart attack. They don't measure heart attacks.
Okay.
But they do. Sugar. Yes, they do measure high blood sugar.
Okay.
So, basically, the study that recently came out shows that all of the work that we've been putting into reducing risk for diabetics is actually paying off.
Yay, medicine.
Yeah.
We're doing something so right.
So, this article makes sure to point out that the number of Americans with diabetes has tripled in the period of the study. So while the risks are dropping, the chance of having a complication is dropping. The number of people who have diabetes who are therefore at risk has tripled. 26 million people have diabetes. And 79 million people have pre-diabetes, which means that they're at high risk of developing diabetes.
So when you have pre-diabetes, proper diet and exercise can help you turn that around and prevent you from moving into full blown.
Yeah, in general, my understanding, again, not a diabetes professional, is that generally the medical advice for pre-diabetes is to lose weight.
Okay.
So that's increasing exercise, maybe eating some more beans and peas. You know, like improving diet, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that can really turn around
diabetes.
And it's
diabetes. Type 1 that you acquire because that obesity is strongly linked to?
No,
it's type 2.
Type 2.
And type 1 is what you get as a kid.
Yes. Type 1 is something that has nothing to do with your lifestyle. Type 2 is linked to lifestyle. Yeah.
All right. So Americans, we're not doing so hot on our end of the bargain. But medical professionals, you figured out how to at least help us not die. when we don't do so hot on our end of the bargain.
Yes. So, I mean, things, basically, more people have diabetes, but if you have diabetes, things are looking better for you than if you had diabetes 25 years ago. It's really what it comes down to.
And if you've got pre-diabetes, eat those beans.
Yeah.
And get that nice young butt skin.
All right. We ready to move on?
Are we at four out of...
We're at number five.
Number five. Ooh. More than halfway.
So this past week was Passover.
Oh.
The Jewish holiday with all kinds of strange...
Matzah.
Yes, kinds of strange culinary restrictions. So the Orthodox Union and authority, I would argue the authority on kosher foods, recently ruled that certain brands of this food could carry its kosher for Passover symbol.
Spelt? Wait, can I guess?
Yes.
I think it's quinoa.
It is quinoa!
I totally saw that headline this week.
Yes.
And I was just thinking about how you all, when we were in college and we had to make matzah mac and cheese, I bet quinoa mac and cheese is a lot more delicious.
Yes, I'm sure it is.
And quinoa pancakes? Like, I feel like you could do a lot with quinoa.
You can do certainly more with quinoa than you can with matzah. So, okay, so this quiz links to an article called Five Things to Know About Quinoa. The first question, what does quinoa taste like?
It's an important question, and I don't know how to describe it. How does...
They say that it tastes like brown rice crossed with oatmeal.
Okay, I see that.
And that it has a light fluffiness akin to a well-prepared couscous.
I would definitely agree that texturally it's a lot like couscous. It's sort of, what, oatmeal mixed with brown rice? I guess so.
It's like,
I would say it's like heartier. A little bit nutty. It's like got that hearty, grainy taste. But it's not particularly strongly flavored. I actually think it's pretty delicious.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever met anybody who's eaten it well-prepared well who strongly dislikes it, whether you want to eat it all the time or
not. It's kind of like not liking rice.
Yeah, there's not a lot to it to dislike. It may not be your favorite thing, but...
Yeah, and the major nutritional thing that makes quinoa so popular is that it's a complete protein, so it has all 9 amino acids that you need, that you have to get through your diet, that your body can't produce.
So vegetarians are big fans.
Though, I didn't realize this, but quinoa is not actually that high in protein.
This is actually interesting. I for a while was tracking what I was eating, and that was something I learned about quinoa, sort of. But I knew that it was a complete protein, and so I just assumed I was doing something wrong. But so it's just not high in protein, but it is a complete protein.
Yes, it has all it has is those 9 amino acids. It's not a substitute for eating tofu or chicken or anything like that.
So if you're preparing a quinoa dish, you should still prepare it
with a protein.
A different protein and more vegetables and things like that. Interesting. Yeah. That actually makes me more likely to eat quinoa.
Yeah. Because you can think of it more like rice. Mm-hmm. And even rice has protein in it, but it's slightly higher in protein than a regular grain, but you still are getting a lot of those same complex carbohydrates that you would with rice or pasta or something.
All right. Like that. Actually, that is very interesting to clarify.
Yeah.
Because I do think of it as a protein source. And I'm not vegetarian, so for me, it really isn't. It's a complex carbohydrate.
Right. I would imagine that it's very good for vegans.
Right.
Because it's so hard to get all of those amino acids.
Especially from natural sources.
Exactly. All right. So you've been doing pretty well.
Got off on a rocky start. Let's see if I can bring it home.
Let's see how you go with this one.
Uh-oh. Not a good sign.
Number 6. Concerns about cancer led the FDA to request doctors to stop performing power morcellation.
Spell that word.
Morcellation.
Okay.
Which is a procedure to treat overeating, bruxism, uterine fibroids, blocked airways.
Let's read that whole question again. Okay.
Okay. So, concerns about cancer led the FDA to request doctors to stop performing power morcellation.
Okay. So let's stop there.
Okay.
So we have a procedure called power morcellation.
Yes.
That doctors were performing.
Yes.
And the FDA is worried that somehow it's related to causing cancer, and so they asked them to stop.
Yes.
So now the question is what that procedure does, what that procedure prevents.
Yes.
And overeating, uterine fibroids. These might not be in order, but these are the ones I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Bruxism.
Bruxism. That's Bruxism. Teeth grinding.
Okay.
And blocked airways.
Okay. More salation.
You didn't take Latin in high school.
No, I did not. I don't think it's blocked airways. I think it's teeth grinding, bruxism.
Bruxism, final answer?
Final answer.
Wrong.
Is it blocked airways?
No, it's uterine fibroids.
All right. Well, you can't win them all. I told you a lot of words I didn't really know.
I told you this was a tough one.
Yeah, it's a lot. I am not a public health professional.
No. I don't know. Never even. Okay. So, power morcellation involves, this is a direct quote, involves using a device to cut tissue into pieces that can be pulled out through the tiny incisions made during minimally invasive surgery.
Oh, gosh.
The devices, known as morcellators, have been widely used in laparoscopic operations to remove fibroid tumors from the uterus or to remove the entire uterus.
Wait, so does that really mean it's like tearing tissue into morsels and then pulling it out?
Morsel. No, not like...
Because that is what I got from what you just read to me.
So it's not morsel like chocolate like chip little, morsels.
A little bit of a treat?
No, it's not like that. It's... morcellation with a C, M-O-R-C-E-L.
That's true. That's spelling. Yeah. That's how I'm going to remember it. Power morcellation removes morsels of uterine fibroids.
So apparently it poses a risk of spreading the cancerous tissue.
Because uterine fibroids could be cancerous themselves?
I don't know.
Yes, if we're spreading cancer, let's assume there's some cancer in there.
Yes. So the thing that's kind of scary about this is that one of the myths about cancer that for the most part has been kind of squashed, but that there are still people who believe it, is that having surgery to remove cancer actually causes the cancer to spread.
Wait, that's a myth?
That's a myth.
Okay.
So there was, at one point, doctors did not want to operate on cancer patients to remove the cancer because they thought that exposing the cancer to the air would give it strength or something and then it would spread.
But it was probably just that by the time it was profound enough to open it up and find it in one place, it had already spread to other places.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So this is really interesting because I wonder what the FDA went through to get to the point where they would say that they thought that this procedure did increase the chance of spreading the cancer.
I didn't really realize that you could increase the risks of spreading cancer in that way. Like, I know that it moves through the body, but I hadn't realized it was sort of catching in some way. Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that they have some reason, but I would actually like to learn more about this.
Like what their specific concerns are and what studies they're basing it on.
And why, because this has been going on for a long time. They've been using this process since the 90s. And I wonder what has
changed. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a few patients who have had some kind of adverse reaction or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Somebody threatening to sue.
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
All right, next question. We got two more.
Okay.
So, man, this is like heavy on the diet and exercise.
Good, because I sort of know things about diet and exercise. Not really, but...
Okay. Women who gained excess weight during pregnancy were more likely to have preschoolers who were obese, were underweight, had attention deficits, or had autism.
Okay, women who gained excess weight during pregnancy were more likely to have preschoolers who...
Yes. So when you look at a woman who gained too much weight, according to her doctor, during her pregnancy, when you look at her preschooler, is that preschooler more likely to be obese, to be underweight, to have attention deficits, or to have autism?
I'm going to throw out underweight, just because that doesn't seem like a thing that I've heard of happening. So, seems most logical is probably that the kid is overweight, but that's almost too simple. So, the other options are attention deficit and autism.
Yep.
I'm going to throw out autism. We're blaming a lot. Everything seems to cause autism, so I'm gonna vote this doesn't.
Okay.
So, it's attention deficit or overweightness. I'm just going to say that we're going to go with the simple connection. Overweight mothers, overweight kids.
Correct.
Yes. Don't make this complicated.
All right. So, there's some new evidence that shows that women who gain too much weight are, let's see, what is the number? They had the kids of women who gained too much weight had a 46% increased risk of being overweight or obese in preschool. And that's adjusted for the mother's age, race, diet, education, BMI before becoming pregnant, and other characteristics.
Okay, wow. Because I think something we've known for a while is that obesity doesn't run in families genetically necessarily, but that environmental a shared environment can lead to obesity for mothers and kids and siblings. But this is even controlling for that, specifically gaining weight during pregnancy.
Right. So it's not – so the Institute of Medicine has – they provide guidelines for weight gain during pregnancy. So if you're of a normal weight, you're supposed to gain between 25 and 35 pounds. If you're underweight, you should gain between 28 and 40 pounds. If you're overweight, you should gain between 15 and 25 pounds. Man, 15, that seems so low.
But I guess if you already have, like...
if you're already carrying around extra weight.
That, like, your baby doesn't weigh 30 pounds when it's born.
Hopefully not.
We all hope that.
Yeah.
So then a lot of that 30 pounds has to be just nutrition for the baby. So like a little bit of fat to give your body some breathing room so the baby doesn't like drain you.
And then if you're obese, the IOM, the guidelines state that you should gain between 11 and 20 pounds if you're already obese when you get pregnant. So...
are you supposed to stop trying to lose weight when you're pregnant? I guess you are.
Yes. You are supposed to stop.
I hadn't thought that part through.
I think that some women lose, if you have really severe morning sickness, some women do lose weight in the first trimester, but in general, you are only supposed to gain weight. Even if you're obese.
Right, that's what I was thinking. That gaining 11 pounds, that's like baby weight. Basically, when you are obese and get pregnant,
yes,
you're basically allowed to gain like...
the weight of the baby and the plus amniotic fluid. And that's it.
That's what you can put on. Interesting.
Yeah.
And so it's if you're more than those ranges that your kid is more likely to be overweight. Right. Interesting.
And what's even more interesting is that women who were not overweight before they got pregnant had an even higher, if they gained too much weight. So if you were a normal weight and you gained more than 35 pounds in your pregnancy, so like a Jessica Simpson type situation, where the tabloids at least speculate that she gained 50 pounds in her last pregnancy, then her child or any other mother who had that much weight gain during her pregnancy was more likely to have an overweight or obese toddler.
But it's okay, because she's got Weight Watchers to sponsor her to get it off. So she can just get Weight Watchers to sponsor her kid, too. It'll be great.
And we're not trying to shame Jessica Simpson. She was just an example. Just an illustration. So, all right, let's get to this last question.
All right, let's see. Make or break.
Okay, this is the last one. Of 1.1 million pregnant women enrolled in Medicaid in 2007, about what percentage were given a prescription for an opioid painkiller?
During pregnancy or during labor?
During, let me check. During pregnancy.
Okay. Ooh.
So, 5%.
Okay.
10%. 17%. 23%.
And this is, read the question one more time.
Of 1.1 million pregnant women enrolled in Medicaid in 2007, about what percentage were given a prescription for an opioid painkiller?
Wow.
So 250,000 pregnant women. Oh no, that was the answer.
You're lucky that I can't do math fast.
Okay. All right. What?
Okay, what were my
options? Don't do the math. 5%, 10%, 17%, 23%.
I guess like 23% because you said 25 no! something. Sorry, I can't.
You get half a point for that.
We can just do it out of 7.
No, you get half a point.
All right, I'll take half a point. I'm fine with it.
Because I gave it
I probably you. Wouldn't have guessed that because I probably would have logicked it down to one of the middle ones. So I only deserve half a point.
Well, yeah, okay, so it wasn't even that 23% were given a prescription. It's that 23% filled a prescription.
Wow.
For an opioid painkiller, which... Is
bad for pregnancy, right?
Well, because you don't we don't really know what the effects are on a fetus.
Is it these were pains unrelated to pregnancy, or this was for pregnancy pain? Like, is this a morning sickness kind of thing, or is this or an achy back thing, or just?
I don't think you give opioid painkillers for morning sickness.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is this like she stabbed her toe and needed opioids? That seems extreme too.
Okay, so the most women took them for a week or less. And about 2% in women, 2% of the women in both studies that this article talks about took them for longer than a week.
Wow.
So that would lead me to believe that it's for some kind of injury or something that happens.
But what they're pointing out is we hadn't thought through have an injury and we don't know what to do. If they're pregnant and have an injury, we don't know what to prescribe them or what not to prescribe them when these two things occur simultaneously.
Well, what's really interesting is that there are lots of regional differences. So this is only women who are enrolled in Medicaid, and that's different for every state.
Okay.
What the Medicaid, what the guidelines are for who can be enrolled in Medicaid and who can't.
Okay.
But the most women... or the highest percentage of pregnant women enrolled in Medicaid who were prescribed opioids lived in Utah.
Interesting.
And Oregon had the lowest percentage with 9.5%, and New York was at 9.6%.
Wait, Washington's where medical marijuana is legal, not Oregon?
Washington, Colorado. I mean, there's more than 20 states where medical marijuana is legal.
Is Oregon one of them?
Yes. Oregon has legalized recreational marijuana.
Okay, so yes. What we're saying is that instead of opioids, maybe the women are smoking.
You can't make that jump. You cannot make that conclusion.
Correlation is not causation?
Yes, exactly.
I don't know how to apply that phrase, apparently. But
I mean, that implies that, you know, women who live in Utah are in more pain than women who live in New York, which seems weird. It seems like there's something
else going on in
there.
Utah? Maybe there's like one doctor who's all about prescribing opioids.
Or maybe there's, maybe there's different reimbursement.
Maybe people are filling prescriptions differently.
Yeah. Maybe doctors are prescribing differently because they are reimbursed differently for different types of visits. You know, I don't know.
Interesting. There's something. Yeah. But yeah, if you're saying if Medicaid state by state, it could be a more systemic.
Yeah, it seems like it's a systems kind of issue. I know that New York has an opioid monitoring system. Unlike other states, that may contribute to the lower prescribing and therefore lower numbers of women prescribing.
Yeah.
I also wonder if there's just different prenatal education in this in the Medicaid population about alternative ways to manage pain while pregnant.
So this would be like women knowing different amounts about what they should even ask for or...
Or just, you know, if the doctors in New York and Oregon are more inclined to say, why don't we try you on Tylenol first instead of writing you a prescription for Tylenol with codeine.
Right, because codeine is an opioid, yeah.
Right. Then, maybe it's just differences between
the
states.
We don't know that opioids are bad for babies. We just don't have enough information to know that they're safe for babies either.
So this article says that the risk to the developing fetus are largely unknown. So I would imagine that there are plenty of babies born every day whose mothers took opioid painkillers.
Yeah, 250,000 women. We would be hearing about epidemics if every mother who took opioids had bad outcomes.
Yeah. We would know, but what we don't know is the problems that do happen
later
in pregnancy, if they are caused by those drugs or if they're caused by other environmental factors or other behavioral factors on the mother's part.
And there must, to say that we don't know the risks, there must be enough concerns that have manifested in particular incidents
mm-hmm.
to raise concerns that require further research.
Yeah. And
interesting.
And what this article ends by talking about Americans being pain averse, and that, like, we as Americans do not like being told by our doctors that if you're pregnant and you're in pain, it kind of sucks. Yeah, you kind of have to deal with it. So there is some patients, there may be, according to this one doctor, patients who are seeking pain relief from what could be a normal discomfort during pregnancy.
Oh.
I don't know. I think that maybe that's, you know, that is one doctor's ideas about what's going on. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's really what's happening.
Or it doesn't have to be a whole explanation. Even if it's true that Americans ask for more pain relief than other doctors, than pregnant or not pregnant in other countries. That sounds believable, but I have no evidence to back that up. But even that doesn't completely explain it, because it does vary state by state, which is one of the interesting things here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that Utahians are more pain-averse and are demanding it, probably.
Right.
So even if Americans do more than other countries, there's still something going on state by state that's changing.
Absolutely.
Opioids specifically versus other things.
Yeah. And I think that is probably where the next more research is going to be.
This very much sounds like an article that's opening up a topic rather than...
Yeah, absolutely. There are some systemic issues happening there. And what I think the next logical step for this would be is to see, are there different health outcomes for infants born in Utah versus New York? Seeing if you can find any kind of correlation between these the women who are enrolled in Medicaid.
So if they're enrolled, we know which women it is who've been prescribed. I mean, we obviously do not hear in this recording session, but theoretically you could track the specific mothers and their specific children. Or maybe that
I don't know.
That kind of data may be privacy protected, I guess. You might be able to get numbers without getting...
I would imagine that HIPAA keeps researchers from knowing that.
So then your solution is probably the best one, which is just looking at...
Yeah, you would have to look at the... Like, on a population level, you wouldn't be able to look at specifics.
Right.
Yeah, just for privacy reasons. So, all right. So that brings us to the end of the quiz, when I'm going to give you your grade.
Uh-oh.
2, 3, 4, 5. So, you got 5.5 out of 7, which is not division I can do in my head. You got a 78.5. So
you know,
got a C.
That's totally passing. It's like a high C, too.
Yes, it is.
It's like a high C. So for a subject that I did not study for, specifically.
Or read anything about.
You know what? I'm going to take it. I feel like passing is better than failing. And a high C. That is a grade to be proud of.
It is. It is. All right. Well, thanks, Jasmine, for
thanks
talking
for having me.
With me about the news in
Look,
the New
I
York
learned
Times.
A lot.
Good. I learned a lot, too.
About pregnancy and diet and exercise.
Hey, look.
And also that bruxism is grinding my teeth, and that morselation is when you turn fibroids into morsels. Thanks for the learning.
And with that, good night. So that was Jessamine. I had a really good time with her doing this quiz, and I was actually thinking that it might be fun to do the quiz with some other guests in the future. So this may be a recurring episode style. I'm not sure. We'll see how it goes. So as always, thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you next week. Bye. Thanks so much for listening to Action Phase. You can find me, Tegan, on Twitter at Tegan Keating, that's TEAGANKEAT. T-I-N-G, and on my site, tegank.com. You can find Action Phase on Twitter at actionphasepod and on actionphasepodcast.com. You can feel free to email me at actionphasepodcast@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.